Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. January 14th, 2014, episode number 49, Jason Brunn's Let 'Em Bee interview. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. This is Kevin England, and I'd like to say welcome to the podcast, and welcome to 2014. For our first episode of the year, we're going to do a first of sorts for the show, and that is a one-on-one interview with Jason Brunn's. Jason's a listener of the podcast and someone that I've shared a number of emails with over the last few years on topics for the podcast and on principles of less is more when dealing with bees. This philosophy of leaving the bees to their own devices is becoming more and more appealing to me, and Jason was gracious enough to come on and accept an invitation to talk about beekeeping in his area and his practices that he has in his own apiary. We made this recording over the weekend and used Microsoft Skype for the process. I must admit I was a bit nervous, and the setup was a little bit hairy as I got it up and running just before Jason came in, but beginner's luck prevailed, and I'm pleased to say that I think the sound quality came out pretty good. It's a lengthy chat, so I won't keep on going here for the intro, but I'll let you get to it. I have a typical show in the works, and if all goes as planned, we'll be back later in the week with our regular installment. I'm happy that this interview worked out and that having the ability to bring a conversation to you, I think, is going to enhance the show this year, and we plan to do this and line up a couple guests to chat with over the course of the year as a normal course of business around here. So once again, thanks, Jason, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come and sit with us. A conversation with Jason Brunn's. Today we're going to talk to Jason Brunn's from Liberty, Indiana. Jason is employed as a hospital pharmacist and also a sideliner beekeeper. He enjoys canning, winemaking, fishing, and hunting, and other activities. He started keeping bees in 2010 and has several hives on his property. And in support of his beekeeping, he maintains a beekeeping blog at letmb.com. I'll give you the address for that in a bit. Jason, welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
Thank you.
You know, we've come to know each other through a series of small email exchanges that got bigger and bigger, and it figured that sooner or later it was a good time to get to talk. I know you're a longtime listener of our podcast, and I learned a little bit about you from your blog and another podcast that you were a guest on. But truth be told, this is the first time we've ever spoken directly. You know, my introduction was pretty high level. Is there anything else you'd like to share?
That pretty much sums up everything that's going on right now. I've got a couple other things going on, but that was pretty extensive. Pretty much sums it up for me.
So, Jason, you live in Indiana. I'm not sure if you're north, south, central, or whatever, but I guess you're at the same latitude as New Jersey. Is that a fair assumption?
You know, my geography is not that good. I'm in the central eastern part of Indiana, on about where I-70 goes through the state, so right in between Indianapolis and Dayton there. So I don't know if you can put that in your mind where that is, but I'm right on the state line with Ohio.
Yeah, general idea of that. And what kind of terrain do you have out there? Is it flat?
Is it extremely flat, heavily agricultural area with broken up little pieces of woods and uninterrupted drainages. Like with there's rivers here, like the East Fork River, and those are that's pretty much the terrain. Flat. It's a glaciated area. That just is agriculture, corn, soybean, monocrops.
Been out there one time to Toledo, Ohio, which I'm guessing is not far from where you're at in relative terms, and it was bone flat all the way through.
That's Toledo's just a little north, and that's it. That sums it up.
All I remember is a guy telling us that you drive on this road, and it's absolutely arrow straight. And if you look down to the left, every time you get to an intersection, there was another road about a mile away running in parallel. And everything was gridded, and the guy kept saying, "You see that stop sign down there? It's 1 mile away." So yeah. I kind of understand. It's really flat, nothing but corn, nothing but soybean or whatever, yeah. And you drive like 6-8 miles, and all of a sudden you'd get to this 90-degree bend that ran for about 100 yards because somebody's property line didn't work.
That is something you have been. That's the way, exactly the way it is here.
Yeah. So listen, you and I converse about things that, and you know that through listening to me through the podcast, what my trials and tribulations are going on. But 2014, I've spent some time over the break. Well, first off, I rebuilt my computers, so I've been off the grid, so to speak. When you're off the grid, you find ways to entertain yourself. And for me, I've read a couple of beekeeping books, a couple of beekeeping blogs, and reading back on some of the old stuff like the Ware method and things like that. How do you keep yourself occupied when you're trying to learn what you're doing about beekeeping?
Oh, I mean, that's reading a lot of those older materials is exactly what I began to do. When I first began beekeeping back in 2010, I was right in line with doing everything just the way as it's described in all the journals. You know, you treat prophylactically, you feed stimulatively in the spring. And I did that for a while. And I was having a lot of failure with what I was doing. It was very complicated. It was a little overwhelming. And I started thinking, this is very, very complicated. We've been keeping bees for thousands of years. There has to be an easier way. So I got into reading about Ware. I got into the Reverend Langstroth's book. Those older books that are free on Google, books.com, there's tons and tons of bee literature out there about all different facets of beekeeping. And you know, Ware's book is there, and it's free. And I mean, there's just so many things that you can get into. You just get into that, and once you get something read, you have another title that you want to read next.
So I've been reading. I read the Langstroth book, a lot of it, and I've been reading the Ware book. I've also been reading this one called The Art and Adventure of Beekeeping. And the fascinating thing about this, it's from a beekeeper who, my guess is it was written sometime in the 80s. I can't really tell by the language of it. The guy's been keeping bees in the 60s, the 70s. And one of the things that he struck is completely towards your blog philosophy, which is let them be. One of the key aspects that I took away from the book, they were talking about opening the hives and never open them until they're 70 degrees. But even when they're 70 degrees and you open it and you let the heat escape, that's a 25 degree difference from where the brood chamber is. And the bees have to compensate for that by recreating the heat and resetting the ecosystem inside the hive. And I thought that was really fascinating. And I find myself looking back to all the naive times when I was in my hives doing things, working around that. You know, and it's funny is you have this conversation where you tell people as a new beekeeper, you have my permission to go ahead and open the hives. You probably heard me say that on a podcast, but there comes a point when you start to figure out that if you leave them be, they're better off for it. And I'm believing in your philosophy, and I'm believing in this year. You know, I tend to shoot a lot of video and a lot of educational stuff, and I have my hives open and I'm shooting and I'm exposing the frames, and I'm wondering if my hives are worse off for it. You know what I mean?
Well, I tell you, I understand it. It is hard when you buy these bees to go to adopt this philosophy that you're not going to do anything, and a lot of the current beekeeping journals and everything, they view it, if you lose a colony, that you have failed as a beekeeper. And that could be, I mean, there are things you could do that could cause that. But there's also a lot of other reasons that a bee colony could fail. And so going through these hives, as I said, when I began, I was doing the every week inspection. And then, you know, you were speaking of Ware's book. Ware He advocated viewing the, or you know, trying to surmise what's going on in the inside of the beehive when you are just doing outside observation. So a lot of the times, you know, people get in their hives in order to, you know, see if the queen's laying. Well, a lot of times, if you see good pollen coming in, you can be relatively certain you got a laying queen in there, and so then you don't need to worry about that per se. I mean, that's something I've noticed. I mean, there's any of a number of reasons that people want to get in there, and you know, some, you know, there's a lot of different things. But opening a hive up, I kind of look at opening a hive up. You have a perfect sterile environment on the inside of a well-functioning, healthy beehive. Mm-hmm. Anything that's in there, you can stick your tongue on.
Yeah.
Well, the bees work very hard to make it that way. And when we open that up, break all those seals, pull frames out, and expose them to open air, I view it a lot as, you know, if you were going to a doctor that every time that they wanted to examine you, they said, well, we're going to open you up and take a look at your heart to see that it's beating. No, we want to look at other ways. Like, you know, they can take your pulse and then they know your heart's beating, as opposed to being so invasive. And I'm telling you, if you sit and monitor your bees prior to your hive manipulation, and then say 15 or 20 minutes, then you monitor those bees 15 or 20 minutes after your hive manipulation, you have to see that disrupts those bees. Have you ever noticed that, or do you ever stick around after you do
without a
hive manipulation?
Doubt, I've seen it. Especially when you're doing manipulate, you know, you talk about certain things that you do. A common practice around here in the spring is you take the hive that has risen up through the box and is sitting right underneath the dome, and you switch a brood chamber and put it on the bottom, and you put the empty frames underneath the dome but above them, right? Do you guys do a spring manipulation like that?
No.
I know you don't do any of those things, but
there, a lot of people around here, and I initially began doing that, but again, that disruption, and I tell you, beekeepers really need to experiment with different things, Kevin. That's one of the reasons why I've listened to your show, is because I see you are a typical beekeeper in that you're always wanting to experiment with something. And that's the only way you can ever really learn. It doesn't matter what you read. You have to experiment with things. So I found out, I actually did an experiment one year and went to the three deeps, because I was losing hives doing the things that I had read I should do. So I'm utilizing these three deeps, and in three deeps, for some reason, they just will build up stronger, and they will create enough of a honey dome. You know, if that top, if the ultimate top deep is full of honey, there's like 80 pounds in there, and they'll never use that in the winter. So you have a good honey dome in there in the spring. You don't have to move anything. You don't have to do anything. You can just come put supers on there.
Yeah.
And that queen's never going to go up in there. You can super early when a lot of beekeepers are waiting for the blossoms. Around here, a huge monofloral crop that we have is black locust. And a lot of times people will wait until they see the locust blooming to try to super up. Well, by the time you
Either
see
too late.
It, you've missed two to three days. And I mean, those are two or three heavy duty days. So by having that honey dome up there, not having to worry about putting your supers on, you can put them on early. With the three deeps, I found they overwinter with more numbers for some reason. Now, they don't totally cover all of the combs in all those deeps, but for some reason they overwinter with more bees, they come through the winter with more surplus feed, and then they build up stronger in the spring.
So you're touching straight on the topics that I'm going to cover in my next episode, and I guess I'll let a little bit of that go here. now and discuss some of that. Walter Wright, do you know him? He's the checkerboarding person. I've talked about him on my podcast in the past. The name ring a bell?
The name does not, but the checkerboarding method does.
Okay, so Tim Ives is the three deep guy, at least current times. There's been other people who've spoken to that beforehand, but what they're talking about, at least some of the things that I've been reading about recently, is leading up to the nectar flow. And when does the nectar flow start in your area? March, April?
Well, I mean, it just depends. I mean, they're gonna, I most likely the biggest part of our nectar is going to be the last week of April, maybe second to last week of April on a good year, to the first week of May, when they'll be bringing in, they'll get very good amounts of pollen prior to that. But
Yeah.
that's when I would call the ne our good nectar flow begins.
We
But
start to
you,
see
there's surprises.
the crocus, the snowdrops, the skunk cabbage, March, early April, dandelions pop mid to late April, and then from late April to May, it's game on in our area. So it sounds like you and I are within a week of each other thereabouts, given your descriptions. So what they're saying is right now, depending on how the weather is in January and February, the hive is working in their cluster and they get an occasional warm day, but then they start to see strings of warm days where they'll move up into the honeydome and they'll start consuming that honey. And the gist is that they'll eat that honey up to a certain point. And hopefully they'll always eat it to the point where they'll leave a reserve. But what they're doing is using that honey and resource inside the hive to build spring bees in anticipation of a swarm. And then eventually the nectar flow will start to come in and they'll build back down through the brood chamber with the nectar and shut the queen off so that she stops laying, she slims down, and you have an abundant workforce, and they will go out and issue the swarm. And the daughter will take over the hive when abundance is coming, and that swarm is best suited to survive because it's being issued at a time where there is going to be reasonable, forage and pollen and so on for them to get established and get going so that they can survive through the winter. And it's this time period right now where they're going through those manipulations and getting ready. And if you know about my experiment last year, I didn't feed my bees in the fall just to see if they would make it. Well, they did. But the problem was, as I realize now, when they got to spring, they had nothing to build a spring population. And the discussion goes like this. In the springtime, they'll get to a point where they make a decision that they're going to swarm or not. And it's predicated on how much resource they have. And if they get to a no-go point where they can't get enough resource to build the bees and then backfill and set that swarm in motion, they'll get into survival mode where they'll just try to make it to the next year, right? So all this discussion about manipulating your hives and all that, one of the things we're having conversations in my association is some of the spring beekeeping of supering and putting in has to come earlier. And what you were just saying is if you wait till in your area the black locust comes, you're too late.
I mean, I've had swarms issue here as early as the 27th of April is, and that's when they're hitting my boxes. There might have been other swarms in other places, but I mean, you know that by that time, that hive made that decision a long time ago that they were going to go ahead and swarm. I mean, that's a, at least six weeks ahead of time, they had to be making preparations to do that. So then you got to be looking, you got to be thinking back about that amount of time. And, you know, like as you said, in a typical beehive, what they'll do in the spring is as the nectar comes in, they will backfill everything they possibly can until they get that queen where she can't lay. So what we're doing is pulling a little bit of a, I mean, you can call it a trick or whatever, but it's just smart animal husbandry. You give them a whole bunch of extra surplus area where they can store honey, and that prevents those good strong hives. I honestly believe, I mean, I think I do probably send out some swarms, But if you give them, you double the size of a three deep configuration using like four to five, maybe six medium supers, and you do that in the second week of March, if that hive is strong enough, and I don't believe that they're going to swarm on you. Unless the queen is deficient and she's getting so old that they just decide to do it.
Yeah, I guess the revelation that a lot of beekeepers don't understand is how much pre-season activity there is. I mean, we all are aware that they're getting ready and they're starting to hatch bees and whatever, but there's a complete system in play. You were talking about supering your hives. We're sitting here in the middle of January as we record this. When do you start doing any activity in Indiana?
As far as getting in to them, I'll go around and observe any day, past mid-February that it gets up to like 65 or 70. I'll go ahead and take apart dead out, so I won't open up anything. A lot of it just depends on how I feel that the year's progressing. If I feel like it's things are starting to bloom and we've made it past that last frost. Normally by about middle of March, I'm opening hives. Between the middle and end of March, I'm opening hives and assessing whether they, assessing how many supers I think they can handle. I look and observe how big I feel that they are, how heavy they are, and you can pretty much tell how many honey supers you're going to need by that. And I'll do that in March, and then I won't get back into those hives until June.
How many hives do you have, Jason?
Well, this right now I have not been replacing losses. I've only got about 17 or 18 right now. I've been keeping about 30, but here over the course of last year or so, I've had a lot of busy stuff going on, and I haven't been able to keep up with as many.
Do you keep them all in one yard, or do you have them spread out?
No, actually, right now I got seven different yards that I'm using, and that's something that I'm moving through 2014. My observations that I have made, I have yards that are productive, and I have yards that are not producing in the same way that other areas. And I have been able to take that and kind of determine. I believe I can figure out in my area where productive yards are going to be. Typically, here, if you can find a cattle farm or a place where there's open pasture around some woods, you can be pretty productive with your bee colonies. In some of these other locations, it is very hard to get surplus honey, even though I believe the bees are, doing their part. They're just having a hard time making any surplus because it's hard to make a living in monocrop soybean and corn.
Yeah, they got to fly a little farther to find whatever they're looking for when in those pastures you have the edges and so on. So the first warm day yesterday here in New Jersey, it was pretty balmy, 65 degrees, but it rained all day long. This morning I went out and took a look. It was in the 40s. It was cold, it was windy, it was overcast. They weren't flying at all. I went out in the afternoon. It was about 45, got a little warmer, and there was direct sun, and all four of my hives were flying today. So they're hanging on there. You can see them going. My sign, at least in the winter, is whenever you see them removing bees after a warm day and you have dead bees on the landing, the hive is still in operation.
Yeah, that's I visited three hives today, and only one of them was active, but that's a hive that will be active when it's cooler. I've noticed with some of my different hives that not all of them will come out on any given day based on the temperature. Some of them like to stay in until it's a little bit warmer. The hive I saw today, it was probably. If it made it to 40 today here, I would be surprised. I'd have to look. But this is a hive that it's 1208 is the number, and they're a humongous hive, and they they keep warm enough that they can send bees down. But other than that, other than the outside observation, I don't open them or look into them any until middle of March or something, unless I am absolutely certain they're dead. You know, you get one of those days in February or early March where, I mean, we've had days here that get 65 or 70 degrees, just your fluke day. And if they're not flying that day, you can rest assured that you need to clean that box out.
I've been surprised by that. I've had a day when it was 60 degrees and all my hives were flying. I was up to 7 a year or two ago. There was one hive that didn't fly, and I was pretty sure it had succumbed. And lo and behold, the next warm day, the thing was out and flying. So you never know by that. This morning, I put an ear, and I could hear the buzz in all the different hives. But, you know, so answer this for me. On your hives, are you running 2 or 3 boxes right now?
On all of them, I'm running 3 boxes.
All running 3. And, you know, some of the commentary about supering is that the bees will move up into the honey chamber when they need more space. They'll consume the honey to build more bees in anticipation of building 2 workforces, one to swarm and one to be there for the nectar flow and sustain the hive. And people are saying that you could take a honey super and stick it underneath the honey dome and emulate that space and let the queen go. And they'll push through that and then still go up into the honey dome and you'll have a mega super workforce. What do you think of that idea?
I don't know. I'd have to read about that. I'd have to try that. I've been busy. I haven't read that specific idea. Typically what I do, I don't know. Every once in a while, you cannot keep them from swarming. There are certain times. You got to be really careful when you're making a lot of heavy manipulations. When I first began beekeeping, it was described to me by this elderly gentleman who kept bees for many years that making a lot of honey and not having swarming is kind of like surfing, and you have to ride this wave. You can't feed them too much or it'll crash over and they'll swarm. But you want to keep feeding them in order to – and, I mean, all of these complicated things. That may work, but I'm telling you, if you leave them alone and you just have 3 boxes and you don't get into them, I think you'll be relatively happy with the workforce you get, and you'll be surprised at how long they'll wait to swarm.
Yeah, you know,
are you following me there?
I am following you. It's very similar to the principle that a person named Oscar Peron was espousing. I think it was in Brazil or Mexico or somewhere in South America, where he built a brood chamber down in the bottom. And what he did was he built a big container and he just ran sticks back and forth. It wouldn't work in the States because it's not movable comb, but his objective was never go in there. And, you know, he was doing a Ware style. He was putting honey supers on the top. And this book that I was reading over the winter here, this is the super scheme that they had. Ready? Slip number 2 super under number 1. In other words, they started with 2 deeps and a honey super that was loaded. So you would put a new drawn out super under number 1. And then as the season comes, you'd slip number 3 super between number 1 and number 2. Then you'd slip number 4 under number 3 but above number 2. And then you'd slip number 5 right above the brood chamber but under all the supers that you'd put on the top of the stack. And if you got to number 6, you would put it under number 2, and you would put number 7 under number 2 and above number 5. I'm obviously reading from some notes, but this guy had it all worked out, and it sounded very similar to something I heard from Tim Ives when he was here in New Jersey not too long ago. He was having this discussion about, you put this one here, and then you put this one here, and you put this one under here. And they had worked out that it was in relief of allowing room for brood and allowing room for honey, and you just kept alternating these things to allow both of those chambers to grow.
To grow.
How about that?
And, well, I believe I've discussed that with Tim a little bit. He didn't have that far hashed out. It's been several months ago. I mean, I can see where that would have some merit. A little bit different than Tim Ives. My bees don't typically have the massive colony sizes that his do. I have a lot of my third deeps that don't have bees covering those combs a substantial part of the year. So I haven't had to get to the point where I have to worry about that brood chamber increasing the size. I can totally, with the types of colony numbers that he has, I don't know if you've have you viewed any of his videos that he has on YouTube?
I only know of him because of the one talk that he gave, and I know he American Bee Journal, one of the two he was in, Bee Culture, he did a lecture.
American Bee Journal.
Yeah, so I've seen him post on Bee Source. Everybody always asks him what he does, and I don't think anybody ever got a straight answer from him.
Straight
That's
answer.
No offense from him. It's just his method is unorthodox, and I think he just has a hard time describing it. They beg him to write a book, which someday he may do, right?
I'm sure he has always seemed very forthright, or, you know, forthcoming with information when I've asked him questions. And a lot of the questions that I've asked him have verified things that I've found. I mean, I don't know. I'm hoping someday I have to worry about, you know, increasing to four deeps like I've seen him do. But that's not a problem right
now.
Yeah,
I love the pictures of him standing on the – yeah, I mean, he's always willing to help and explain. But I think what happens is he's answering a point-in-time question for somebody, and it's not the whole picture, and people try and interpret how it all works because they've heard other things that he's said. And then he comes back and says, no, that's not exactly right. So I think while he's trying to be helpful, he confuses people. But, you know, let me ask you about black locusts. I've heard over and over again, and especially in our region where people have fortunate aspect of having black locusts, when it's going, it is hammer time for the bees, right? They just can't build fast enough or store it fast enough. Is that a correct assumption?
That's pretty correct. That's why I try to have a lot of drawn-out combs ready for that event. In 2010, I hit it a little bit, but this year I really hit it good in a couple of yards that had good, strong colonies. And now I know I'm aware that Tim Ives does some pretty fancy manipulations with his supers and how he changes them around. I typically add them in the spring, and then I add another one when I feel that they're full. I'll peek in the top. I mean, you can tell when honey supers are full by the way the bees are acting. If they're acting like they don't have anything to do, they need more to do. And you can see that in outside observation and in watching them. But that's typically the way I hit it, is I put those on. And if you have a good strong yard, again, in an area where there is black locust, I mean, I've seen them fill five medium supers over the course of 5 days this last year.
Yeah.
One of my 1109 was one of my colonies. I couldn't believe it. I got there and I pulled those supers in August, and I was used to pulling all these, you know, full season multifloral honeys, and I pulled those off, and I looked down at those caps and they were all white, and I just couldn't believe I kept pulling them off and pulling them off and pulling them off. Is great.
I have a friend who has his hive situated down near a river, and when the black locust is flowing, he's just going all day and all night putting the boxes on the hives. And I can't say I'm that fortunate. I've never seen it, but it sounds like a fascinating thing to experience.
You just are very fortunate the years that you get to hit it. Unfortunately, it comes during a time of the year, in first part of May there, that we have a lot of storms here. And those flowers are very delicate, and it doesn't take much of a storm, and they'll be all laying on the ground, and the bees could miss it. So it's a hit or miss thing. You don't get black locust every year reliably.
So Jason, you involved in any beekeeping associations out in your area?
Well, I have been minimally involved in the Southeastern Indiana Beekeepers Association. I've gone to a couple of their meetings. I have a couple of really good beekeeping friends that are in my area. The closest association for me is about an hour and 15 minute drive, and I just can't do that the first Thursday of every month.
Yeah, that's a lot of work. Do you have people you mentor at all, or associate
I've got
with?
I've got a guy who actually is a reader from the blog who he found out that somebody named Bruns bought the property across the road from him, and he had been reading for a while on the blog, and he sent me this email, and he said, "Oh yeah, that's me." And I gave him a caught swarm this year. I believe it did die, but I've been kind of helping him out with some things and getting him some swarm traps going. And I've got a couple other people that I wouldn't say I mentor them, but they're kind of in this in what is beekeeping right now, where you're trying to figure out what you're doing. They're doing interesting things to try to figure out what they're doing too. And so I work with about three or four other people, and we get together and extract honey together and kind of share work that way. But as far as associations, it's just really hard being that far away to make it.
Yeah, an hour and something doesn't sound appealing, and you probably know from listening to the podcast, I'm pretty active in mine, and we have a lot of stuff going on. What's the philosophy on feeding and treatments and varroa and hive beetles out there? Do you want to tackle that question?
Well, I don't. You want to talk about what's out there or what I'm doing? Because what's out there, there's a lot of stuff out
Let's
there.
Let's do both. What's the common wisdom out there? I'm assuming everybody has varroa, right? But I don't think you probably don't have, being similar latitude, you don't have much problem with hive beetle, I'm guessing, right?
Well, last year we did not. The previous year we had, at least myself, I don't know if it had to do with this my particular colonies or what, but we had a bad year for hive beetles. Now, this last year, not so bad. But varroa are everywhere, and most of the people around here do your treatments for varroa. They do some form of treatment for beetles, whether it be traps or some of these other things you see on the internet where they're taking insecticide and putting it on the inside of CD jewel cases.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I just think it's better to not do those things. I've got a lot of good customers that I've gotten. I'm not a humongous honey producer, but you know, I've got a very devoted group of customers, and they've come to expect high quality. And one of the things I tell them, I don't feed, and I believe you can taste a difference, and it means a lot to me to make sure I'm feeding them honey and not feeding them you know, just sugar that the bees have made into like a honey like substance.
Yeah.
So that's what, and really, if I one of the things that I've been I had emailed you the other day about the Kiwi Mana Buzz. Speaking to that gentleman that let's see, his name was Tyson Kaiser, and he was out, I believe, in Los Angeles or someplace in California, talking about how many feral bee colonies were living in Southern California, and bees are living in my area, which is a very hard agricultural area, and nobody's feeding those bees. I would venture to say, even if you don't think they're there, you got bees living around you, and they're making it without being fed. And that's really the genetic stock you should be trying to get anyway. And if they can make it without being fed, they can not only make enough for them, but they can make you a good enough amount of honey that it would be worth your time taking care of them. Have you ever had any reports of feral colonies in your or been called to a cutout near yourself?
I can't say that. Well, first off, I can name probably a half dozen beekeepers that live within 8 miles of me in a radius where they're keeping their bees here. So anything that's in a house or doing whatever is probably an issued swarm from an organized beekeeper that got off. In fact, I was just told by somebody recently that the farm across the street from me, unbeknownst to me, has a feral swarm inside one of their barns, and they want to take it out of the roof this spring, and we're going to go do a cutout on that. But, you know, Tom Seeley, who's pretty renowned about, you know, feral bees and so on, he's in the Arnott Forest in New York State. He's in a forest. We don't have a lot of hard stand of large woods, but my guess is where there are woods, there's probably feral bees around here. I live on a wooded lot. I have mature 100-plus-year oak trees all around, and I can't say I've ever seen a sign of it. But who knows? It could be right there, you know?
They are very, very good at keeping a low profile. I mean, there's people that I've been called to cutouts in their houses, and they tell me, oh, I think they just came this spring. And I get in there, and it looks like they've been in there for a couple of years. I mean, there'll be old black brood comb. And the people just didn't notice it. They went around the side of their house. They were going to cut away some brush that was really kind of blocking the entrance and exit from the hive, and they just began to notice it at that time. So they could be around, and I'm just the bees that are out there, again, along with not being fed, they're not being treated for varroa. And one of the things that this Tyson Kaiser spoke about on the Kiwi Monobuzz was that, yes, initially, and I was told when I began beekeeping, all the feral colonies are dead. They're gone. And I believe that until I began seeing swarms flying around in May and being called to people's houses for nuisance bees moving into houses. And, you know, living in an area like I do, bees should not live here. If you read the conventional there should be no way bees should be able to live here where I live. I mean, it is a hard place for them to live, and yet they're doing it, and they overwinter strong. They're productive, and I mean, I also read there in American Bee Journal. I don't know what his first name is. His last name is Mangus. Have you ever read any? He does a lot of top bar stuff.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. I met him at the American Beekeeper Federation conference. Is it Walt? I should know this, but I don't recall.
I can't recall off the top of my head, but I've had some emails with him. He had done an article on feral colonies making a resurgence, and I'm seeing what he's seeing here, that the feral stock here is doing well. They're living anywhere they can. I've taken bees out of block buildings, you know, concrete block buildings. You give them a place to live, and they'll move in there, and they'll set up shop, and they'll do well. And that's, you know, with all these different hive types, Mr. Perrone, I totally believe he has a great idea. It is sad that as beekeepers, we have these laws that tell us what kind of hive we can keep.
Yeah.
And the hives that they allow us to keep wouldn't have been legal for thousands of years of beekeeping history. And, you know, maybe some of the problems we're having with bees today has to do with how easy it is to take those hives apart and get in there and you know, dig around in a place maybe we don't need to be.
You know, as you listen to me, that I'm experimenting, right?
Yes, sir.
I just got a styrofoam hive that I think is very interesting. One of the things I've learned in Europe is that I think it was Denmark. The guy told me that 80% of the beekeepers will never buy a wooden hive again. They're keeping them in these styrofoam hives, like the one that I bought. And I have a long hive to deploy. And I'm just fascinated more from like a master beekeeping kind of thing of having experience to do these. And I'm not some evangelist that says Langstroth hives are never right. But, you know, I think about conversations that I've had with Deb Delaney or hearing Seeley or them talking about feral bees. And one of the things they say is they live in a pocket where we don't see them. They're way up high in the trees. They actually stay in the canopy and they forage from there and they live a different lifestyle. And it is perhaps true that they're living outside of the varroa infestation because they're not down on the floor intermixing with the bees that we're dealing with, or they come from different genetic stock. And I also think that the environment inside the trees that they're living in, small hole, moisture, cambium, biology inside the hive, maybe the mites are there that we've killed by our acaricides, all that stuff. You have to think the ecosystem is unmolested in those type of environments. And, yeah, hopefully someone will discover these things and bring them to the populace. But for now, we have what we have, you know.
And that's all we can do is experiment. You'll have to let us all know what the longevity is on those styrofoam hives. I've read about them. I've been intrigued by them. You know, people talk about the Langstroth-style hive. If you know from reading his book, people vilify this hive that they claim he made. But if you read his book, what we're currently using and calling a Langstroth hive is not quite exactly as he described it.
Yeah, it's different.
It is different. I mean, it's
even the way
the
we set them
size
on the ground and things like that. He had them situated differently with airflow underneath them. And
right. So I think it has less to do with the hive type. I think, you know, they may see that in their area. Here in my area, in fact, just up the road from me, there is a tree, and I see this a lot here where there are. I think that most of them are maple trees that will have rotted out roots right at the base of the tree. And I know of four or five beehives around here where that happens. I see them at all levels. I see them high in trees. I've seen them up as high as 25 or 30 feet. I also see them at eye level and, as I said, right at the ground. So I think to a bee, what's the most important is that they have this cavity size. And then, you know, as far as whatever kind of hive you want to keep, whatever kind you decide to get, just stay out of it. And I think that you'll be amazed with how much success you have.
I think I can equate it to like a Democrat and a Republican. On many matters, both of them sound right, but you never know which one is actually true. You talk about a Langstroth hive. You know, people say that wood is the right substrate because it breathes. It allows things to pass in between and out. Styrofoam, no good because it's going to control the moisture. But I say to myself, well, isn't that the job of the bees to control the moisture? And if they're inside a tree is a lot thicker than a 3/4 inch Langstroth. So there's all this notion of who's right and who's wrong. I don't know the answer to that. And I don't think that If you look at the Langstroth hive, it has evolved to be purely a mechanism for commercial beekeeping. Pallets, things like that, it's strictly utility from that standpoint. And I don't know that there's a good answer to it, a boutique hive, a hobbyist hive that could be better for the bees. But, you know, I look at Anacree Hives and Sam Comfort. He's keeping them in garbage pails.
Yeah. So, you know. That guy is straight up my alley. I've read a lot of things that he's has on his webpage and watched a lot of his videos. And you know what? Just what he's doing. You know, I think beekeepers – I mean, I remember when I first started getting caught up in this, who's right and who's wrong. The big secret is if anybody was right, every single person would be keeping bees like them because they'd already have it figured out because everybody knows there's right that they were right. The key is that I don't think there is any right or wrong. Keeping bees for me, even though, you know, on a piece of paper we may be in the same climate zone, it is going to be different for me here than it is for you where you're at. And for me to be able to – I mean – I talk about a different way, and I try to talk about the successes and failures I have where I'm at. I don't know that those things will work for other people, but I want them to understand that I don't arrive at these ideas, you know, just based on dumb luck. If you observe the things you do and experiment with little different things, you will find ways that increase the productivity of your bees, and that's the best thing that you can do for them. So, I mean, it's I don't know. I hate it when people are talking right and wrong, and you see it a lot on these forums.
Yes.
You know,
yeah. Forums are poison.
Vsource, I like using Vsource in the spring to track when bees are swarming. But my gosh, some of the things that get said on there between the people who, man, we're all just trying to keep bees. And I mean, I've seen people get relatively rude on there, and there's just no need for that, because way I keep bees here, it's going to be different in Southern California. And I mean, there's a lot of people that are on Vsource that are there, and they're all competitive, and I don't know, right and wrong. Everybody just needs to, I mean, we're all doing this to try to make these bees survive. If we all just, you know, share what we're doing and let everybody work it out for themselves, I think the bees will be a heck of a lot better off.
I wrote a blog post last year on Vsource, and this is the point of poison, right? There's a lot of good creativity and a lot of help, and I don't want to condemn it, because I go over there and look occasionally, but I posted something about one of my episodes being available, and somebody came back and thanked me for the effort and made a comment somewhere underneath about, I don't even remember the reference, but someone else came in and immediately called the guy out about his philosophy. And then they got in this exchange, and I came in afterwards. It just pushed the wrong button for me. I got mad and just said, you know, really, you have to do this? You know, why are you trolling, kind of thing? I posted this. You know, I felt bad afterwards for doing it, but the guy deserved to be called out. It was just inappropriate. And to that point, it really aggravated the crap out of me. But
you brought up you know, Democrat, Republican. It's the same thing. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. If people have deep-seated beliefs, I say just keep doing those things and get back with me in the future and see where I'm at. If I'm totally out of beekeeping, then evidently it didn't work out for me. But I'm having success. I am excited about that success. I want to share it with other people. I don't want to fight about it. I mean, there's other people that are doing things differently than myself. And, you know, I take not feeding and not treating. Many years, 2 years ago, I was speaking with Anita Dealey off of beverlybees.com. I don't know if you've ever. You mentioned them on your show.
I did, yeah.
And my first interaction with her was she was a little bit irritated with me. I guess maybe feeling like I was kind of cruel to my bees for not feeding them. And it was kind of a fiery exchange. But I didn't want to make her mad. She took the time to read something I wrote. But I wanted her to see why I was doing these things. I mean, I'm doing this from an animal husbandry point of view. You know, you can't look at our bees as pets. They're not going to live forever. They're not immortal. A colony of bees is not, we can't just get them in that box and say, well, they're going to live forever. And some of them are going to survive and some of them aren't. And it's not always our fault. And bees have been feeding themselves since they became bees. I don't know when we as humans got to the point where we felt that, you know, nothing on this earth can survive without us, but they were doing just fine. I know that there are bees being kept in places that are very hard for bees to make it. And if you live in one of those places, I guess feed your bees, do what you got to do. But you got to ask, you have to temper that with, you know, what you're up against, and you know your chance of success in that kind of paradigm is not very good. So you can't blame your bees, and you can't blame yourself if you choose to keep them in that location.
There's a certain part of beekeeping as a practice, though, that requires you to feed your bees. I mean, if you just got a package delivered to you from Georgia, if that's how you got started, and you put them in a hive with foundation, and they didn't come from a swarm that just, you know, where they fed up and bulked up and got prepped, but they got plucked out of a hive, shipped to New Jersey or Indiana, and got stuck in a box with no resources, you're going to have to feed them. I mean, I don't see how else you could do it. But then after they get fed and they have honey and they have all that, then theoretically, you should not have to feed them. Yes?
Well, and that's if that's how you source your bees, I do not advocate buying those packages. I only bought two packages of bees ever, and both of them failed relatively quickly. And I, at that time, I was feeding them. But they, you know, people feed them, and they still fail. What I advocate is, and like I say, you have to have feral bees in your area. But you know, I catch between 15 and 20, I think that my high has been 23 feral colonies every year in these boxes.
Did you have a lot of swarm activity this past year?
Now, this past year, I only caught 14. But
we
I only,
were down
I only...
so low in New Jersey, like the numbers, because I took the swarm report. The numbers were down significantly last year for whatever reason.
I could believe it. Here in my area was a very hard – this was a very hard year. After we got through June, July and August was a total dearth. They didn't do anything. And so all of my swarms were very, very early, and they came from areas – I've been doing this swarm trapping for long enough. I have come to know – the maybe kind of different groups. They're like different gangs. They have similar attributes. Certain areas swarm earlier and their coloration. But the places where the three or four places where I have really strong colonies and a lot of them, I caught a lot of colonies.
Are they somebody else's swarms? How do you know that the difference between a feral and
you
one
don't.
That came from
you
your
don't.
Hive or somebody else's?
You don't for 100% certain. Like these bees, currently where I live, I rent, and I've been renting here for several years. But there are bees that have been living in the trees here since the 80s, since the Varroa came through, and they were here before I came here. I know of seven or eight bee trees around here, but. So I know that the areas where I'm catching bees and there are not kept bees, that those are feral. Now, I have places where I very well could be catching someone's kept hive. But the thing is I don't treat them and I don't feed them. And if I put them in a, you know, if I take that trap and I put that in into a hive and install it and they overwinter, I don't care where they came from.
Yeah.
I mean, none of the bees here in North America are from North America, but they're here. So it's
well, you're
just
also
like,
putting them in your yard where you have those genetics to feed from, right? In around me, unfortunately, even if I put 20 in my yard, I still have commercial beekeepers near me enough that my stuff is flying over and mating with their stuff. I'm not getting feral stock, but you know, you have to, I think about what you said. And if anybody came to me and wanted to get started in beekeeping, you know, I would tell them about the package thing if they did it, but I wouldn't encourage them. I think you've heard me discuss the fact that I don't, and that talk about getting flamed once. I made a statement once about, I would not encourage somebody to use packaged bees, and they lit me up on the forum. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, people have them, people buy them. For me as a podcaster, I meet people who buy bees and they want to know what to do with them, you know? So I have to explain that you have to feed them. And I have people who tell me it's blasphemy to tell these people that buy their bees and then, oh my God, you got to feed them. I mean, you know, of course they bought them from Georgia. They spent $100-something. They had them shipped here and they're going to put them in a box. I'm going to tell them to feed them. What else should I tell them? You know,
it would be hypocritical for me to say not to, because I did that, but I tell you, we would have a lot more well-educated beekeepers if they would, you know, take a look at that and say, I mean, I know I speak to beekeepers who get packages every year and then they die. I mean, it is hard. Even if you do feed them and treat them, it's hard to get packages through the winter. I mean, that's the general consensus from beekeepers
I'd
that
say
I know
it's a
in 50-50 my area.
Shot. I mean, I've known a lot of people who started with packages, and they did just fine. The folks down the street from me started with packages. And, you know, the other thing, too, is where you're getting your packages from. There are some legitimate. Yeah. I don't want to say the word some. There are many legitimate package providers, and then there's ones that are like factories. And how do you tell the difference? I don't know. But when you work with a reputable supplier who has a connection to bees, if they're selling you bees and they're selling you package bees that they're bringing up or they're getting shipped and they die all the time, they got to handle the headache of that, right? So there are some networks for getting package bees that actually work. The problem is, I think, the duress of the sheer number of beekeepers over the last couple of years has overwhelmed the system and has made difficulties in the quality of those operations and letting them get mated, and people want their bees earlier and they want more packages than they can rightfully supply. That itself, I think, has probably impacted the beekeeping industry more than anything.
Yeah. It's got to be hard. There's beekeeping has generated a lot of there's just been a lot of interest here in the last several years. But I tell you, I know you're a busy guy, but if you don't have time, I will send you a swarm trap if you'll at least put one out. I mean, you may be surprised, even if you do catch someone else's swarm. I would say you catching someone else's swarm from genetics that overwintered in your area is a better than a 50-50% or a 50-50 chance of overwintering for you in the subsequent year. You understand what I'm saying? If you catch your neighbor's swarm, I think you have they're just as likely to overwinter as a package.
It's one of those things that when the swarm issued, it has to have the right conditions in order for the swarm to even leave. So, you know, they got started on a journey. They don't leave when they think they're going to be okay. They leave when they know they're going to leave to populate a new colony. And they have the best chance of survival, and they're probably taking the right genetic soup and all that other stuff because this is nature propagating the species. So you have to believe that any swarm that you capture within reason, except for those after swarms and things like that, it's probably the best suited survival mechanism that you have for overwintering your bees.
And you're not shelling out all this money. It's once you build this thing, once you build a trap, you got it built. And I mean, there is no way I could be doing what I'm doing if I was every year going out and buying these bees and having to do the complicated, because that's another thing. It's not only just the fact that you have to feed them. You got to be careful feeding bees. It's not just like you can put it in front of of your grown child and they'll feed themselves. You got to worry about drowning them. You got to worry about the stuff fermenting. All of these other things. You got to worry about the stuff getting too cold. If you're feeding liquid, that's a full other complication all on itself, and that just makes beekeeping even more complicated and hard for the new person.
What is your philosophy on doing splits or the nuke system that I talked about in my last episode? Do you ever play in that area?
I have not yet. That's a 2014. I'm actually, from some discussions I've been having on Facebook with Tim Ives, I'm going to be doing splitting the way he does, where my super strong colonies. This is a problem I've had with beekeeping. You know, the fundamentals, the way that it is done now. According to beekeeping method, we're supposed to have these our good colonies that come through the winter. We should split those. That's the common. We should split those colonies because they're strong. Well, what Tim is doing is his super strong colonies. He's not splitting those. Those are the ones that are going to give you the most honey crop. So you super those, and the bees that make it through, but you could use better genetics, he's splitting those colonies and then doing walkaway splits and letting them make their own queens, and then those queens go out and get bred by drones. That the colonies that you leave alone, and that are making your honey, those queens should be hopefully laying a lot of drones. And then so that way, hopefully your successful colonies are sending out good drones to mate with these virgin queens. That's the kind of that's where I'm going in 2014.
Philosophy. If you've listened to the Michael Palmer things that I've been talking about on the podcast, he's a huge advocate of never split your strongest colonies. Always split your weak stuff up and then give them good genetic stock and let them restart that way, you know. And he does take some of his strong stock every once in a while, and he makes queens out of them so that he could populate the hives that are not performing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, I have discussed it with friends of mine. You know, everybody gripes about taxes and how when you do better, they just want to take more from you. Well, if you look at that's what we're doing with our beekeeping. You have this good, strong colony, and, you know, they do really good, and what a way to reward them. You know, you make it through winter, you're doing really good. Here is a – we're going to split you and put you under a huge amount of stress. And those are your moneymaker colonies that are going to do the best for production for you, and you're not going to have to mess with them. Splitting is stressful. I would rather take a colony that's, you know, I would rather fiddle around and experiment with my less productive and profitable colonies.
So Jason, are you ensuring your queen health? You got a good, strong hive, runs great for a season. How do you know the next season it's going to come back and bang the whole season, or do you replace her in the fall in anticipation to having young virile queen for the spring? I mean, what's your strategy there? You just letting them be?
My strategy has been letting them be. I did lose one colony this summer that I believe tried to requeen and they failed. But I have never replaced a queen ever in a colony. I've got a colony that has been alive since 2010, and I know that at least once or twice they've superseded. I let them be and do what they need to do. I am very fortunate that I don't live in a high metropolitan area. I am not afraid to send out a swarm every once in a while,
yeah,
and give back to the bank that I'm drawing from all the time. Anytime I catch a feral hive, because all, as I said before, all of the bees that are here in the United States, they're not from here, so they found a way to live here. They found a way to live with the waxworm. They're going to find a way to live with the varroa mite, and they'll find a way to live with the small hive beetle if we just let them do what millions of years of evolution has allowed them to do.
So I wish no ill will towards your beekeeping prospects, but I know my common pattern that I've seen since I've started is you'll build a hive, it'll go great for 2 years, it'll look good on the third year, and it's the fourth year that something goes wrong. The ecosystem in the hive gets screwed up or something, and then you almost have to start from scratch. It's a 2 to 3 year run, four if you're really lucky. So I'm curious to sync back with you next time this year and see if you saw any detriment to your hive and how they're working in your operation from a queen standpoint. Because I don't know if it's the buildup of who knows what inside the hive, or maybe, you know, in our area, treatments are something that people do. The combination of treatments over a period of time change things. I don't know how that is. So have your hives ever been treated?
The only thing I ever did was the powdered sugar method.
And have you ever – do you ever do mite counts at all?
No. The way that I know that I have been able to see that I have mite problems is, you know, I do put the trays in there, but I don't really do mite counts. I will have the inserts underneath the screen bottom boards, in the wintertime, and I'll take them off and I'll see, I may see Varroa there. I am kind of teetering away from using screen bottom boards in favor of using just all my closed bottom boards, because as I said, I have a lot of ferals here. I spend a lot of time tracking them down and observing them. A lot of the ferals that I've done cutouts on, when you get inside them, that comb is so old and black that it's been occupied for more than 2 or 3 years. The whole where the entrance is will be totally black with propolis. That is multiple years old. And then reports from people that, like, I did a cutout last year, and the people said, "Man, that house has been abandoned for 25 years, and those bees have been there ever since then." And I mean, it was a massive, powerful colony. And that comb is that many years old, and the bees are living on it. I don't know. I mean, I use all foundationless comb. I don't know. I mean, as we said earlier, there are so many experts who tell us what to do, and I don't know.
So
I've become
you're running
disillusioned.
foundationless, you said?
Yes.
No foundation at all, or a starter strip?
I'm sorry. Let me restate that. I use no foundation in my brood chambers.
Okay.
And those are all the deeps. The Langstroth Deeps frames that come from Walter Kelly Company. And I don't use starter strips. Initially, I used to paint those with wax, but I don't even do that anymore. As I typically catch the swarms in the spring, and there'll be one drawn out piece of old comb. I don't back to what you were saying before, I don't get disillusioned when I lose a hive. I do lose them from time to time. I mean, I'm thinking this year I'm going to lose quite a few. Last year was a hard year here, and this year our winter has been way more brutal than normal, and I know I'm going to lose bees. But all of those dead colonies, I'm going to be able to get brood comb from to bait my traps, and it's not the end of the world. I mean, if you're buying them, it might be the end of the world. I would hate to have, spent $100 or $125 on every colony of bees I've ever had, because I would be th this little operation. I would my wife would have made me quit this a long time ago. But you just can't look at every lost colony as a bad thing. I do know that going into next year, any swarms I do catch are going to be some really good bees, because the colonies they came from overwintered this winter, and it was a hard winter. So everything's not always, there's always a little bit of good to go with the bad. And as a beekeeper, you gotta, I mean, I'm not gonna lie to anybody, beekeeping's hard. It's a hard thing to do. And you're gonna have failures. But if you can catch your bees, and I outline how to do that all on my web page, and it's they can make the traps, and they're free, and it'll I think it's
What
something that
do your traps look like? I've seen many different styles. Just curious about the ones that you use in particular.
mine look like old dilapidated Langstroth Deeps, because that's what I use. Anytime I can, I take care of a lot of bees around here for some older beekeepers, guys in their 80s that they can't do the lifting and stuff, but they still want some colonies to look at. It's something they enjoy, and they have a lot of old equipment, so that's what I make them out of. There's a gentleman, man, he's out of Texas. I can't remember what his name is. He had a book on swarm traps and bait hives, I believe is the title of the book. McCartney Taylor. And it discusses in there about that a European colony looks for a cavity size of about 35 liters to go to swarm. That's what those scouts are looking for, supposedly. And just so happens one Langstroth Deep is about that size. And so I put a top and a bottom on that, and I hang that to a tree. And